Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello. How are you doing there? Welcome back. You made it back to episode 9. No, 10. 11? I don't know what episode this is, and I just turned my computer off so it wasn't so loud on the recording. So I'm not going to turn it back on to then tell you whatever episode it is. You know what episode it is. Anyway, ramble. Just that, just straight in, 30 seconds, Dan rambling. But yeah, thank you everyone for coming back. It's been going really well. I'm really happy for you all. Happy for you all. Like, this is good for you people. What are you calling you people, Dan? I'm really happy personally for how well it's been going and stuff. I feel like I took a bit of a risk. You know, I didn't know if people would want to listen. And you do, which is beyond me. So, this week's guest, musician who I first heard about maybe 15 years ago, maybe? Is it really that long? I used to knock about at a club. It wasn't a club, it was a night called Cracked at the Rising Sun, which was like IDM and breakcore and experimental I nearly said shenanigans again, didn't I? And it was just an inspiring night for me, and it's probably the early seeds of me getting into music as a performer. I was always into music, but you know what I mean. And Tim's name was one of those. I haven't even said his name yet. Yeah, I'll just call him Tim. Tim's name was one that was always bandied around as someone to get to see if you got the chance. So roll forward this many years, and I got to get him on the podcast. So yeah, this week it's Tim Exile, music producer, but more recently he is like a crazy tech man making really, really interesting instruments for Native Instruments, which I use, also making virtual instruments that he sells off his own site. But this isn't just your run-of-the-mill, this synth goes bloop bloop. This is finding a new sound, finding something maybe you hadn't thought of before. So it was an honor to get to talk to him. The music you're hearing right now, in fact, is made using entirely his new project, which is called Endless, three S's. You can find that at endless.fm. And I wanted to show you it, but I didn't want to show you like a fully finished, completely produced version of what it can do. Because I don't think that's the truth of things. If I'd taken it all into my computer after the fact and EQ'd everything and edited and all that, it would have just been a little bit of a lie. So what you're hearing is while I was on the tube, basically. So this is all the journeys I take to get to podcasts, and there's been a lot in the last few weeks. I'll pull out my phone and I'll just have a little play with myself on the tube. We'll go into more detail about what the app is in the podcast, but what you're hearing now is all made in Endless. The only thing I've done is thrown it into my computer so I can arrange it a little bit so it feels more song-shaped. It's pretty inspiring stuff, considering I'm doing this just on the tube, rammed in with sweaty businessmen looking at me going, what the f*** is that guy doing? Why is he pressing his phone? Why is he moving his fingers around? But yeah, you can loop and chop and just play with sounds and this isn't a perfect track by any means. It's nowhere near finished by any means. But as you listen, from what you can hear under my rambling, there's definitely ideas that are worth following. And yeah, no, it's the app that sort of got me back into making music after a long few months where I just didn't want to. If Tim's listening, I don't know if he's going to listen to his own voice, but I wouldn't listen to my own voice. But yeah, I've got to thank Tim for that. We don't just talk about tech this episode. We talk about Buddhism and mental health again. But it's another good one, I think. I personally think it's another good one. But that's for you lot to decide. If you want to get hold of Endless, the app, it's in beta at the moment. So it's free. You're not having to pay anything. But there are a few caveats to it. It's iOS only at the moment because Android doesn't handle audio as well as iOS does. So just one platform at a time makes a hell of a lot of sense. And there's a bit of an install process. But if you do want it, the tweet that brought you here on my Twitter, at Dan Lasak, there'll be a link to it in the thread of that. And that will link you into a jam and it will take you through how to get it on. Also, I'll make my fortnightly podcast is out now post on Patreon public. So if you go to patreon.com/DanLasak, it should be the top post there, whether you're a Patreon or not. It'll have the link in there and you can get in the jam. Everyone who signs up to that link will get into the same jam, same little area, so you can all collaborate together on making noise. Or you can just hit the jam solo button, so you can do it all privately as you learn how to make. I think they're called Fire Beats. I'm not sure. It's been a long time since I was relevant. I might even jump in the jam you lot are in and like remix and play with what you've made. Don't be scared. And talking about Patreon, thank you again to everyone who supports on there. It does mean a lot. Like, it does make it a lot easier for me to go and travel to people and actually talk face to face. Is there anything else I need to say? I feel like I've said a lot. I'll talk to you in a minute once we've finished the pod. Hey, why don't we just have a listen to me and Tim having a little chat about everything? Basically, this one covers a lot. And I hope you enjoy it. Wait. I forget every single time to ask you to hit the subscribe button or the like button and things. It's because I'm bad at my job. Anyway, on with the show.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I know. We can rerun it. I thought you were recording it.
No.
It'd be nice little intro.
I have to say it. You know, it's rude not to say. Like, oh, I'm recording now. You can stop being racist.
Oh, no, but I thought I wanted to get...
You were going to be racist.
Yeah, well, that's... Yeah. Just FYI, listeners who weren't listening when we were not recording, Dan's task for this podcast is to frame me as being incredibly racist.
Incredibly
but
racist.
But just by editing.
But against all races equally. Because that's equality.
Yeah. I mean, can you be racistest?
The racistest.
The racistest.
You could easily be the racistest.
I'm probably more the racistestest. Actually, no, I'm not the racistestest. There are people who are more racist.
I reckon
anyway.
Yeah. It's a job now, being racist. Like, it's a valid career path at the moment. Yeah, what do you want to be when you grow up? A racist YouTuber. Excellent.
Yeah.
It's a good future.
Yeah, it's bright. The future's YouTube.
I'm glad we're going to...
Orange Tube.
You know, die in about 40 years. We've got about 40 years left, haven't we? Before people start just exploding in flames or something.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's also kind of roughly coterminous with the end of our lives, natural end of our lives anyway, so it's all right.
Yeah, I keep thanking my mum. Well done.
Good. Great timing.
Ten years later, and that would have sucked. So that's a cheery way to start a podcast.
Armageddon. So Armageddon. We started Armageddon. And
which isn't a bad movie.
No, it's not. Oh, I got it.
It's the Bruce Willis one.
Right, yeah. You see, I got confused for a moment with Apocalypse Now. Which is also a good movie, but
it's a great movie.
It's an awesome movie. It's a long and painful movie.
I remember being like 15 and going, having to read Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, no, I never read it.
I had to at school.
Oh, right. Is that English lit?
Yeah. Which is, it's weird. I never really think about the fact that we separate the technical and the creative side of English.
I always kind of like, not externally, but I always internally poured a bit of scorn on the idea that there's like, you study English language. Well, like, didn't you nail that when you were like six?
Six, yeah. But I suppose we can, this leads to you, because you...
What, nailed language when I was six?
You nailed language when you were six. No, the separation between the technical and the creative, you've spent the last decade or more doing is trying to fuse them back together. That making the technical work for you in a creative way.
Yeah.
And then get out of your way. So you can...
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's like, getting out of the way. But it's kind of... It's almost like... It's just... That's kind of how life is, really.
Mm.
You know, technology is basically admin.
Mm.
And creativity is kind of life.
Musical spreadsheets,
yeah. Yeah. Which, I mean, and I think for me, like, I often found the experience of making music with existing tech was, you know, just very admin heavy.
Mm.
Which basically meant that you'd have to do a lot of learning and a lot of kind of making things disappear between the sort of subconscious conscious boundary. In order to get into some kind of flow state. And I mean, I do remember getting kind of into the flow state using Pro Tools, like, you know, like 20 or so years ago. You know, when I kind of got to grips with all the key commands and stuff, and I'd get into this real micro-editing stuff. But it was a very weird kind of hidden flow state.
Mm.
And it just, I think, since then, you know, it's not that I didn't get kind of creative enjoyment or fulfillment out of doing that. It was just like bloody hell, did it really need to take that long to get to that point?
Yeah.
And also, did it really need to take so long when you're at that point to execute the stuff that you were doing, you know?
Mm. So for you listening, what we mean by a flow state is that point at which while you're creating something, it happens. You know how people say, like, or it just the song was already in me and it came out, or, you know, I'm revealing the sculpture that's already in the granite, sort of thing. It's that point at which you're not having to actively think, what do I do next? And the ability to do that. And you've built, you're quite well known for having built a big digital machine called the Flow Machine that lets you do that live
and
create from that point.
Yeah, that's it. That was the goal. Yeah,
that was the goal.
Yeah.
How long has it taken you to build that machine, though, the Flow Machine?
Well, I think the first, I mean, it kind of ran in iterations. So, I mean, the first like proper live noodling instrument that I made that was, well, by that I mean basically a reactor patch. Reactor was this kind of digital modular patching environment that I kind of programmed everything in and mapped to a sort of hardware MIDI controller that you can plug into this thing. So you have this kind of experience of, you know, you're hitting buttons. Yeah. And moving faders, and what you're doing is kind of both like live and unplanned enough and sort of fully fleshed out enough in terms of like the sound that comes out to kind of count as some sort of complete live performance.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's like the minimal thing of some sort of live performance instrument or electronic music live performance instrument. And the first one I did of those, that was like 2003. But I mean, that was super basic. I was still kind of learning my programming chops then. But then kind of iterated that. And then like 2004, 2005 was the first one. That was when I first started doing like proper gigs and started.
Yeah.
That's when I started getting like booked to do these shows. And then that one, that kind of evolved over, well, from like 2003 to kind of 2007, 2008 maybe, and 2007 I kind of like started to mothball it and, you know, bin it and work on the new Flow Machine, which was like completely rebuilt from scratch. Mm. Like completely new concepts. I kind of learned all the stuff that all the kind of cul-de-sacs that I wouldn't have known about that I had to make the first one to learn about. So I had a list of cul-de-sacs that I wanted to make a machine that didn't leave
you in that corner.
Yeah. And so that was much less kind of iterative. So that had a much more, I just made this entire design of the thing that I was going to build. And it probably took me about, I mean, it wasn't full time because I was writing an album. I was writing an album at the same time. Mm. So I was like writing an album and making the Flow Machine. And I did both of those kind of in parallel over about 2 years.
So would Cabaret Lounge be the first iteration of the Flow Machine?
Yes.
And then Listening Tree be the second iteration?
So Gabriel Lounge was literally like sort of stereo out recordings of live shows I did with the first Flow Machine.
So if you jump onto Spotify, listeners, people, and listen to Gabriel Lounge, that's live, that's all happening in the moment.
Yeah.
Tim's clearly drunk.
Yeah, no, it's pretty raucous and
it's anarchic.
It's anarchic, yeah.
Yeah, to go from listening to Gabaret Lounge to Listening Tree in a day. So while I was doing my research and stuff and da da da, listening through, and yeah, like 2006 was Gabaret Lounge, but
yes.
Obviously that's a collection of stuff that happened in the years preceding it.
Yeah, I mean most of that was recorded 2005, and I kind of edited it together. I think it was like end of 2005. And then it came out 2006, I think.
It's like a really sweaty album.
Yeah, I mean it's really punk.
Yeah,
it's kind of it's angry. It's like, yeah, it's a therapy album. Well, like, as all albums are. Well, for me, I don't know if they are for you, but like, there's always some.
Everything's catharsis.
Yes.
Every time I do anything, open my mouth, anything that goes into the world is me trying to get rid of something.
No, that's totally, yeah.
But like, it's kind of interesting because it feels like Gabriel Lounge was this sweaty moment in your life where you were just having fun, and then Listening Tree feels like more shimmering. It feels like you've got a nice suit on.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? It's like it's almost like you've gone from ketamine to cocaine? No.
yeah.
I mean, to a certain extent. Yeah. But like,
ketamine to Prosecco.
To Prosecco. Was that an active choice to do a more, for a first-time listener, Gabriel Lounge might be quite scary.
Yeah.
Whereas Listening Tree, it's got singing on it. I get, it's got this. Oh, there's an actual melody there and stuff. Was that an active choice? Was that?
Yeah, it was pretty premeditated. I mean, I'd go as far as to say it was too premeditated.
Mm.
I mean, it's you know, when I listened back to the album, it sounds something. There's something a bit like I was definitely trying to. I mean, it was a weird time. You know, I was kind of, you know, I was in my 20s. I'd done that whole, like, you know, I had a delayed teenhood. You know, I sort of did the stuff that I should have done when I was like 14, 15, when I was 25. And obviously, if you do that later, it becomes a bit more kind of sparky. The Gabaret Lounge was definitely like that happening. It was like, it was my kind of teenage rebellion happening 10 years too late. Not too late, just 10 years late. It was what it was.
It's just happening when it had to happen.
Yeah. And then Listening Tree was. Listening Tree was trying to do the opposite thing.
Yeah.
You know, trying to show like, oh, okay, now I'm the opposite of anarchic. I'm going to write like,
radio friendly
pop. You know, I'm sort of prove. I mean, they're both kind of like some attempt at trying to prove myself, but it's a weird thing. Like, it's kind of, you know, weirdly, that's another angle on probably why I got into improv, which is, I hope I'm not jumping the gun on some of your questions, but
questions?
Questions.
Written random words on piece of paper.
I mean, you do see, you've got an impressive notebook of...
I hold the pen. I don't already use it, you know?
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's... Basically, whenever I'm given, like, a kind of unlimited amount of time to second, third, fourth, fifth guess what I'm doing, I just get monumentally stuck up my own arse.
Mm.
And I start getting either kind of like a anarchic and rebellious, or sort of like smug and obsequious and, you know, sort of high horsey.
Yeah.
Or some kind of weird personality. It sort of feels like what's really cool about improv is that all this stuff comes and goes, you know, you're pretty naked. Like, you can't sort of make a conscious decision to kind of massage some kind of idea of who you are.
Was that drive to improvise partly being in that breakcore-y IDM kind of scene? And I think different people in the scene, especially around like the early 2000s going into sort of 2005-ish, there were some people who were putting a hell of a lot more effort in than others.
Yeah.
So like, it felt like everyone was trying to be so different that a lot of people ended up sounding the same. So
yeah.
Was that improvisation, that need to do that, a way of differentiating yourself from everyone else?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some of that, you know, sort of wanting to differentiate myself, wanting to stand out, you know, wanting to... Well, I guess also because it was kind of hard to do, you know, it was hard to learn how to program this stuff. I mean, you know, it took quite a lot of time and stuff. So I guess, you know, while a lot of my sort of contemporaries were, you know, like... sort of moving breaks around in Cubase and kind of sampling, like finding trashy songs to sample. You know, I also did some of that, but I think my smug side was like, well, I'm going to teach myself how to program.
Mm.
I'm going to program machines that allow me to do this live. I mean, you know, it's this weird sort of like psychological ecosystem. I mean, I'm a massive narcissist. I've always, you know, my parents are, I hope they're not listening, but you know, they're very... It's a very nice way to put it. I mean, my parents are very, you know, achievement and status, not necessarily financial, but more like your sort of academic, you know, just being good, being incredible, being outstanding has always been very important to them. So, you know, like they put themselves, putting them, you know, the family through a lot of sort of hardship to send me to boarding school, you know, stuff like that. So that kind of stuff is important to them. So, you know, you inherit that.
You picked up the violin at 5. Was that your parents, like, you should play an instrument?
Weirdly, so my mum says that was actually, apparently that was the first thing I said yes to. You know, we had this little, like, carbon copy note from the school, like, does your son/daughter want to learn to play the violin? And
my
mum opened it, looked at me, said, I'm going to play the violin, do you? And I was just like, yeah. Hell yeah! Of course I want to play the violin. Why would you assume I wouldn't want to play the violin? but I think that sentiment lasted probably 6 hours or so, and then I was playing the violin, and then it was a massive fight, and then it did become, you know, a bit, it was my sort of, it's kind of my mum's cause célèbre, you know, me playing the violin and...
Pride and...
Pride stuff.
It's just an interesting one because obviously a lot of people our age would have gravitated towards guitars, you know, and it's kind of, you brought the violin through into performance as well later down the line. Did you?
No.
I think I always associate Zan Lyons.
Oh,
the
right.
The fact that he does it with you.
Yeah, I never did. I never did. I sort of, again, it was kind of part of that sort of angry teen, late teen, 25-year-old rebellion. It's just like, you know, I'm, you know, not picking up the violin. I mean, I still have my old violin.
Mm.
It's probably in a... I don't even know if the strings are still there.
Yeah.
It might even just be a sort of pile of dust now. But,
yeah.
I haven't picked it up.
And no, you don't want to. But you would have picked it up if you wanted to.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I mean, you know, often when I'm kind of pitching Endless and pitch, you know, this kind of stuff, the thing that I often open up is that the sort of opening gambit is, you know, my first musical experience was the violin, and I loved playing the violin because I did actually, you know, I did kind of partly love playing the violin. And I loved playing the violin because, essentially, you know, I could put my bow on the string, wiggle my body, sound and music comes out, and when I stop wiggling my body, the music stops coming out. So, you know, it's music as a verb, music as something you do, music as an activity. And that was the element of the violin that I loved. And, you know, now what, you know, well, all my time really goes into sort of trying to make that a reality for the modern electronic sound world and for, you know, a lot of other people and not just me to be able to do that.
You bring up the point of a lot of other people. You have a fairly unique sound. The way you create sounds is different to other people. It's like because you're programming, because you're building your own bespoke tools, that leads you to building things that aren't just the obvious, hey, I've got an analog synth here, and it sounds like most other analog synths. But you've put those in the world. You know, there's... I find it really interesting. Like, musicians spend a lot of time trying to craft their sound, and that's a private thing. That's, well, this is, I sound like me.
Mm.
You know, why would I give the world the ability to sound like me? Whereas with your VST plugins for Native Instruments and then the ones you're selling on your site and now Endless, you're giving people the opportunity to do something that previously maybe only you or only limited people could do.
Yeah.
What's the question though, Dan? I've just made a statement. How do you feel about that difference between like sharing and selfishness? Like, because you could monetize the Flow Machine. Like, you haven't released an album in a long while, but you could be releasing albums that people are like, how does he do that? And building from there and not giving the world it.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know, maybe it's my kind of perfectionist, but I mean, I've got, I've probably got like 20 or 30 albums worth of recordings of the Flow Machine.
Yeah.
I mean, there wouldn't be 20, you know, none of them would be outstanding. Maybe you could get some, no, to be fair, maybe, three or four, like, pretty nice albums. I mean, they're not going to, you know, they're not going to kind of, like, change the world of music forever, but, you know, decent albums. And I've got a few, I've probably got, like, 10, 20 or so tracks that I've edited down from recordings I've made from the Flow Machine. So, you know, I probably could put an album together if I wanted to. But it's just not, I think, you know, I do, like, weirdly, nowadays, now I've, like, totally dedicated my... all my days to making improv a thing, making it fun, making it collaborative, and making it something that like loads of people can do at, you know, at a certain kind of scale. I do weirdly fantasize more about making albums again, and I've got all these ideas. But the thing is, like, my fantasy is so, you know, I spent 15 years developing technology for improv, and now I actually fantasize. I've got a whole, like, I've got notebooks of kind of ideas and stuff for basically a new kind of composing environment, basically. Yeah. That will be like, I mean, that's kind of my next thing.
Project.
That's, yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking like many years, I think, but to come back to the original question about what, you know, how do I feel about that? I mean, you know, the really honest naked truth about it is probably like, where do you get your cash and your recognition from?
Mm.
Because, you know, if I go back 10-12 years, I, you know, I've 12 years ago when my bread and butter was from the live shows and making albums, there was like, you know, I was like any other musician for whom that is the case. I was very protective about my sound.
Yeah.
And I didn't give any of my software away. I was, you know, I was actually active. I remember I did this feature for Native Instruments in 2005 about the first kind of flow machine thing called the Key Masher.
Mm.
And they wanted me to do a kind of demo version release. And I basically like deleted all the labels and mangled everything up so you couldn't actually understand, so you couldn't unpick it. I actually went to effort. And you know, it was probably my biggest lesson in like public relations is don't do that.
I did like for when me and Pip released Logic of Chance, I had computer music or future music, one of those, come to my house at the time. And they like spent an hour in the studio and we chatted. And I spent like the whole day before like putting synths on stands and just making it look like an actual studio, not just the weird. Because if I wanted to use a synth, it was leant against the wall before and I'd drag it out. And then when they were asking me about production techniques, so I was like, oh yeah, I use this reverb and all this and that. And I was like, no, I just use the generic shit in Ableton and turn the knobs until it sounds right, you know?
Yeah.
Wanting to look like you know what you're doing, but you do know what you're doing. The reason why someone's listening to your music is because you know what you're doing. But yeah, I felt like I had to lie to be, you know, I'm a real musician, not this shambling mess.
I mean, I think whatever you end up doing, you know, whatever kind of creative endeavor you end up doing, there's always some kind of area of stuff where there's an element of paranoia about someone stealing a march on you or like doing your idea and doing it better and all that kind of stuff.
Really, that kind of leads to Endless in a sense because we've mentioned it, but we haven't said what it is. Endless is a collaborative improvisational environment looper synth drum machine
choppy social thing.
It's an app for making music and you can make that music with other people online at the same time. And
I mean that's what it is now, where it sort of
where it'll end up is still is probably the community will decide that to a certain extent.
I think it's a
but no, I've forgotten the point now. I segued into because of something you said, and then
People stealing a march on you.
But yeah, so obviously you're building this app and this environment, but is there any fear there that someone, Native Instruments, Korg, will come along and go?
Yeah, it's weird. It's probably, you know, as a genuine threat, it's probably more real than it is as an artist. Because basically, as an artist with your own sound, there is zero threat. To someone coming along and stealing your sound. That it's like any idea that you have about that is just unfounded. Mm. And what other artists can do is maybe come along and be a bit more savvy about their marketing and be a bit more tuned into their audience and or do something, get some other stuff right. But in terms of like, that's the last thing you have to worry about as an artist. You know, as a business, as a startup with a new. You know, we're a sort of we're a challenger music tech product. And you know, I do feel confident that there's a bunch of good ideas in there that have been like developed and tested over, you know, 20 years or so of R&D and now sort of 3 or 4 years of actually building a code base. But let's say, you know, some really big, like, you know, Native or Ableton or even Apple, if they wanted to come along and take what we've done and make their own thing. I mean, yeah, they could. But, you know, there are a lot of advantages of being this little kind of like David to the Goliath of this world. That, you know, firstly, we're taking a massive risk. You know, because it is, I mean, you know, I feel really confident, and what's happened in the first couple of months of the beta has kind of proved that we're really onto something.
So you, how far into the beta are you now?
So 2 months, pretty much to the day.
To the day.
Yeah.
And what, you're way over 1,000, like...
Yeah, yeah, we've got like, over 1,000 sign-ups and installs, yeah. And it's really growing, and we're not even, you know, you can't...
And that's still just word of mouth, really.
it's all word of mouth. No. I mean, it's like over 80%. I mean, the sort of installs we've got are over 80%. Organic, you know, people who've just been recommended it by friends. And the thing is that you have to have an invitation, you have to have a link to get it. And there are some kind of like secret public links. Well, not secret, but there are some public links around on the internet. But
yeah,
you can't just find it and get it. So it's all word of mouth. But you know, we're in the beginning. We were growing like, you know, like 10-20% a day by word of mouth. You know, it's kind of tail off a bit now, but it's still, you know, like 1-2%.
You're going word of mouth, though, you'll have those spikes. Like, success for any creative endeavor is often comes through outside influence. Like, it only takes like a big YouTuber to come along and turn around and go, "Hey, check this out."
Yeah,
you know, it only works if the product's good in the first place.
Yeah,
well, to believe that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm also really clear that we're nowhere near there yet. I mean, you know, you have to download the test flight. I mean, you know, test flight alone, probably we lose like 50% of our people through just like, don't like test flight. And then the accounts, the accounts thing, the app is kind of buggy. There's still a whole bunch of like back-end data stuff.
Sell it, Tim. Sell it.
Yeah, sorry. You're right.
No, but
but this is like, you know, just talking really frankly about where we're at. You know, just to kind of like put this in context, we're also like basically we have a whole bunch of technical humps to get over, which we should do at the phase we're at. This is why we're in beta.
Yeah.
To work out what these problems are. Well, it's kind of two things. We want to work out what the problems are, what the bugs are, like how to scale the technology. Because it's, you know, this is like challenger outside of tech that no one's done before. You know, we're using kind of like database frameworks that aren't really designed for this. And, you know, it's outside of stuff. But it's also an outsider use case. So, and it's a, you know, it's what, well, in kind of startup world, it's what you call white spacing, where you're actually, you know, we're sort of doing an iPad, you know, we're trying to
cut that into racism. That would be easy.
Yeah. Oh no, I set myself up for it. I mean, it makes sense that it's kind of like buggy. We've got loads of problems because this is why we're in beta, to identify those problems. But then the flip side, pretty much every day. Well, every day there's someone who uses it more than 6 hours, and most days there's someone who uses it for 10 hours.
Yeah,
it's insane the amount of time that once people kind of like get into the rabbit hole, they just use it and use it and use it, and the community. You know, we've already got like, I'd say there's like 20 diehard users who are on, you know, like every day without fail, which is incredible. Like given how buggy and crashy it is, and how much stuff doesn't work yet. It's incredible and really promising.
But it's kind of, you're actually using a beta for what, a beta?
Yeah, I know. Everyone says beta. I should get on the beta thing. It just sounds it should be spelt like B-A-T-E-R.
Yeah,
it's not how we smell it. Smell it.
I have to bounce between both. I get
right. Confused. Okay.
But. Like, you're actually using it for that. Like, obviously I do a lot of gaming related stuff, and the games industry, although it has betas, it doesn't actually. The betas are used as a like, hey, early access. You get if you pre-order, you get access. So like, they're a fear of missing out device to sell the product.
Yeah, it's a marketing thing.
And then when the product actually launches, that first month of the final product being launched is their beta, you know.
Yeah.
Electronic Arts releasing Anthem earlier this year, and it was trash. It was like unfinished and like a buggy mess. But they were big companies are like, well, yeah, if we lose 20% of the player base, that's fine because they've already fucking paid.
Yeah. Which
I think is a frustrating thing, and it is really nice to see you all working on this in an honest way. So when you say it's buggy, it's because you're honest. And
yeah, I mean, it's important. I think especially when you're kind of building something for musicians as well, that, you know, there has to be like an extra level of honesty. That,
yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, the most, you know, the most important people for us to kind of, you know, for Endless to become a success is, you know, practicing musicians.
Mm.
And, you know, we have to kind of, it's important for them to be on the side.
Mm.
So we've got, you know, we've got discussion threads going on. We've got this Discord server because basically we don't have any social stuff in the app yet. It's literally, you can just join a jam, which you have to find from somewhere outside. Either you have to be invited with an invite code, or you have to find one of these like invite links on the internet. But once you're in the app, you can't find any other people. You can't find any other jams.
Yeah.
So we've got this Discord server where our kind of like hardcore users are congregating to meet up with each other and share jam invites and share ideas and so on. And, you know, so we've got conversations there. You know, people are talking, people are like asking about monetization. And so, you know, I'm literally there posting about like what our ideas are about how to monetize it and stuff like that. So, which is quite, yeah, it's pretty unusual for
a... Obviously, me and you have talked to a bunch previously about monetization, but it is the best way to monetize a product is the way in which the people who are going to use it
make money
want to do it.
Oh, right, okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah.
Like, having the people who are actually using the app say, you know what, I'd be willing to pay for this feature or in this way, at least means you can be honest about that, rather than, again, going back to gaming and using, you know, some games deliberately slow your progress through the game or make the game ever slightly harder to encourage you to buy a XP booster or a currency booster or whatever, just to make your experience a little easier.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait, so my game is worse because I haven't spent more money. You know, like, that's not how it's meant to work. Like, things in life are meant to be, I enjoyed that so much, I want to buy the t-shirt.
Yeah.
I feel like that's what you're doing.
That's
the goal.
So already we're seeing there's a few really hardcore Endless users who are kind of clubbing together and sort of kind of goading each other on to become better. They're sharing. Someone opened a channel on our on the Discord called like Higher Teachings, where, you know, people who really, you know, these kind of like 10-hour a day types are sharing all these little tips that are like weird things that we didn't even know that the app did.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like weird bugs. I mean, if you do this and this and this, you can get it in this state and do that.
Yeah.
And then you can get it to do this. So there's already a culture of kind of like almost like sporting excellence emerging. And I think, you know, the people, you know, once we have all this social stuff and discovery stuff, and once we have a kind of like TikTok style, you know, front page, when you download the app from the App Store, like the first thing you see is like a bunch of riffs, and you can scroll through and it says like, this riff was made in collaboration with these people in this jam. And then you're like, you can go onto another riff, or you can explore those people, or you can explore that jam and get, you know, get into the rabbit hole that way. Then that basically the whole value, like at the sort of top end of it, what's going to pull people in is just the amazing riffs. That's gonna be your first contact. So like, if you know, when you first get into football because you know, you see it on TV and you see some amazing goal from some amazing player, you're just like, wow, that looks so cool,
I want to do that.
And then you sort of get into this whole the fun end of football, where you're kicking around a ball with your mates and it's fun and it's social and your skills get better. But, you know, so like football, you know, these footballers get paid a huge amount. And, you know, I'm not going to say that our top Endlesses are ever going to pay a huge amount. But, you know, if it all works out, you know, my dream is really to kind of turn that, you know, that there's an opportunity to turn music making into something a bit like a sport, but like a creative sport somehow, where you can see people doing amazing stuff, but it's not it's not about the result. It's not about kind of like making some track.
Yeah.
Like what is the result? It's just kind of the document of what happened. So when you see one of these riffs on Endless, it's just like, oh wow, that sounds cool. And that sounds like a cool magic moment. And I want to get involved in cool magic moments. So I want to start to up my game as a jammer.
It sounds like the joy of kicking the ball rather than the end result of where the ball goes. Like, yeah. Inspiring people to like, that looks like fun, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is an interesting one. Like, obviously, I've used the app a bunch, and it's almost too easy. Like, I suppose that's partially I've got experience, but genuinely think there's the way it's built, once you kind of learn just the way round. I think a lot of people who have never made music before, well, I've got proof of it. There's one of my Twitch subs is Hi Tom. I uses the app, and he had never made music before, and he jumps in every couple of days, and he has a little noodle, and he said to me the other day, he's like, I don't know why I'm not going to make anything. And I was like, well, that's, you don't have to know why. Are you enjoying it? It's like, people spend a vast amount of time on their phones and devices playing Candy Crush or whatever. And I would like, personally, I would like music making or painting or any of the creative arts to be Candy Crush.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I mean, I mean, that's like such a great pitch for what Endless is. Right? On a certain level. I mean, obviously, you know, we also want to incentivize like really good music makers to come along and master Endless and bring their mastery of other things along to just become a true badass. But you know, that's exactly what I see it as. It's like Candy Crush. It occupies the same life space as Candy Crush.
It's a funny one, because we use our phones to distract us. You know, the amount of time in your day where you're looking at your phone for no apparent reason, and it is really nice to be able to use that distraction time and actually feel like you've achieved something that isn't about getting a number to go up. You know, when you're on Twitter, you're writing a tweet because that you're aiming to get followers or likes or whatever. Or I don't do that really on Twitter. I just cry. I just complain about the music industry, knowing that the follower count will go down.
I hate that experience. I do get swayed by the follower count. If I post something goofy and my follower count goes down, I'm like, oh.
Yeah, I used to have an extension for Chrome. I can't remember what it was called now, that hid all the followers, the numbers.
Yeah.
Off Twitter, which was actually quite nice. Because then you weren't, you know, and I never look at the reactions. I only go to mentions on Twitter. So yeah. I'm not seeing just everyone hitting heart or retweet. I only see if someone says, hey, Dan, you're a dickhead. which happens a lot.
Does it? I follow your tweets quite, because I like your tweets and I follow them quite closely. So
what happens now and again is I'll dip into, because I've got friends in the like more anarchic YouTube community. So I might dip into something over there, but there's people who are actively out there just looking to attack people in there. Yeah. And because I've got the little blue tick next to my name, that means he's worth attacking as well.
Right,
So you do get that, which is fun. But if you don't follow me, I don't respond. That's my...
Yeah.
Basically, if someone's already following me, I know they know me and deserve some form of response. But if they're just salt farming on the internet...
Yeah. I'm always like... I think I'm over diplomatic sometimes online. I get very. I remember, like on Project Rockpool, like so we've got this Facebook group that we launched.
Is the Facebook group still active?
I think so. I mean, full disclosure, I've just been massively busy, and I've, you know, well, my eyes are on the Discord channel these days.
And a lot of people have come over from Rock.
I think a lot of people have come over. Yeah. So we had this Facebook group that we started kind of when we started researching Endless. And then, you know, as you know, the idea was, it was always going to be like a separate thing from Endless. So we didn't want to kind of like own it, but we wanted to start this space where we could kind of talk about the bigger questions about music, etc. But Noel, who's our designer, he posted something. You know, he does quite a lot of posting on behalf of Endless, and he posted something about the gender balance in electronic music, and just like, why is the gender balance so imbalanced? And you know, and when I saw that, I was as soon as I saw that post go up, I was just like, this is not going to go well.
This is not going to go well.
This is not going to go well at all. But actually, weirdly, so yeah, it did sort of kick off a bit, and then a few of the trolls piled in when you know, there was some sort of quite you know, some quite sort of robust criticisms of the gender imbalance, and then there were some robust defences, and then the trolls came in, and then, you know, a couple of people got banned. but in the end, it kind of turned around all right. I mean, but I remember doing a sort of like a diplomatic post at the end.
It's really awkward because, like, when you're trying to create a product as such, when you're a business, obviously you don't want to ostracize people at the same time as you still want to represent your values, you know? And it's trying to find that line, you know, like Burger King at the moment getting, obviously this isn't going out for a couple of weeks, but Burger King getting shouted at for posting that they're still selling milkshakes.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, and it's like, it's a really enjoyable tweet because it is Burger King saying, like,
yeah, putting their hand up for a certain side of the argument.
For a certain side of the argument. And then, but there's a huge amount of people on the other side of the argument saying, oh, this is encouraging political violence and all this. And it's like, well, if we're meant to accept a European candidate's rape jokes as jokes, you now have to accept Burger King's milkshake joke as a joke. I'm sorry. You can't have it both ways.
But it's not, I mean, it's never going to be like that. And that's the whole sort of like weird sort of this strange sort of infantile zone that we're in, where it's just, you know, people from one side of the argument get het up about something. And
I, from my personal experience, I just think us as boys have had like free reign over pretty much everything for a long time. When someone says we should be doing more to encourage women into electronic music, that's not saying we don't want men in electronic music. That's just saying we want more women to be doing this. You know?
There's no dialing down involved in that. You know, not dialing men down, just dialing women up, I suppose.
Yeah.
If you can say that.
I think we can say that.
I get so second-guessy when I speak on this topic. I'm just like, yeah. You know,
but like,
are you going to edit this? How are you going to edit this, Dan?
This is going to be you're going to get
slaughtered.
The women are coming. The feminists are coming to get you. But like it's a really interesting. I complain less on the internet than I used to because I've become quite aware of the fact that in the old privilege bingo, I've done all right. I mean, I live in the West. I have a penis and I'm white.
I've
done all right. I went to university. I had to pay myself, parents. Fucking hell.
parents bashing podcast.
Yeah. Well, we were working class. So like, and it's funny. And it's not funny. It's sad. But my mum had just had a stroke before I went. And then my dad was working so hard. He was a milkman at the time. And the cold, damp bottles. And then as they heated up, his hands just, like, they were messy. Like, every line on his hand was like a crevasse.
Oh, God.
All split open. So, yeah, I paid for myself because I didn't want to ask. Yeah, you know, you're both quite fucked up at the minute. Can I have some money?
You know? Wow. Good. But,
But like, yeah, but knowing that I have some, I have a head start, means that I'm going to be less complainy.
Yeah.
I think that's why most of my complaints are focused in on companies misbehaving or like the bullshit that Spotify say and things like that, because that's something that I can complain about, but if they fixed it, would benefit all musicians rather than just benefit me.
Right, yeah.
Why does no one book me? No, they keep booking women in front of me.
No, right, that's not a thing. Yeah.
I could edit myself into sounding awful now. talking about tech, a few times we've talked and you've just come off or just been going on like a tech detox, like 4 days away from technology. What's the inspiration behind that?
Well, I mean, I sort of, you know, when... so I moved back from Berlin in 2010. I was living in Berlin for 3.5 years. And it all ties into this kind of, you know, the personal journey. But, you know, so, you know, 25 years old, finally did my teenage phase.
How long were you in Berlin?
3.5 years.
Because it's basically, for you people who don't know, if you're doing anything left of centre in music, chances are, you can make it work in Berlin. There's a scene, there's venues, there's people willing to listen.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a really cool place to kind of get something left of centre off the ground. So, yeah, I sort of fled to Berlin to kind of get away from my conditioning. And then started therapy in Berlin and then kind of like all the, you know, all the... flushed out all the demons, told my family to fuck off forever.
Said sorry 6 months later.
And then said, said sorry 6 months later and still feel guilty about the... I mean, oh, God, bless them, my poor mum and dad. I mean, to think what... You know, because I did literally say, I'm not sure if I ever want to have a relationship with you. Oh, God, it's just... what a horror... I mean, what an arsehole. But anyway, you know...
But we
go through these things.
We can.
And we grow, you know.
Everything, you know, I've been in... this is the longest period in the last 10 years that I've been out of therapy, out of any form of counselling. But I've been in and out for a long time, and I know there's stuff that I just built up over years and never challenged and never dealt with. And as soon as you get into it, that first sort of, the first few months where you're still being defensive are fine. And then when it
hits,
person actually gets you to say something true. It's like
and the entire ice shelf falls off green. And your world turns upside down.
And you've been holding it all back for so long. You didn't have to express it at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But hopefully, like, familial bonds are strong enough to go. He was going through something. It's fine.
Yeah. And they were, you know.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, it's one of those things that you know, for me, it just never, you know, so I did therapy for 3 years of Berlin. I mean, I'd done a bit of therapy beforehand, but I never really, I never got past that defensive stage. And then I really did in Berlin. I kind of, you know, made a bit of a breakthrough. But it's weird, these kind of like therapy breakthroughs you make, you make this breakthrough and for 5 days you think that you've solved humanity. Like, not just your own problems, but everyone else's. And now you know how everyone else should solve their lives as well. It's like, it's horrible. And then, you know, it's, you know, 3 or 4 months later, the old tendencies are back there. So it's more like, you know, you kind of learn to work with the tendencies you've got. And that is like a path of practice is just unending.
Well, we talk about mental health as mental health, but I suppose...
It's a weird way of talking about it.
There's an argument to call it, like, say, mental fitness. Like, and fitness, as we know, you go running and stuff. I occasionally walk up the stairs. But like,
this is the first one I've been for in like 2 or 3 weeks, just FYI.
He literally just finished running. But yeah, like, you have to work it. It's not something that just, once you get your brain feeling good, it doesn't just stay that way. You have to actively approach it and deal with it.
Yeah. And like, all, you know, all the sort of the conditioning that... you know, I mean, I've done all sorts of stuff. You know, I've kind of, God, that sounds like, well, I've done all sorts of stuff. But anyway, yeah, I was kind of seeking into like getting into Buddhism when I moved back from. So I did like therapy thing in Berlin, moved back to London, moved to this building that we're in now, 2010, and this is 5 minutes from the London Buddhist Centre.
Yeah,
And I was kind of like, my interest had been piqued in Buddhism, you know, a few years before that. I was just like, yeah, this is there's something here, you know, I want to find out about it. So anyway, I started going on to the London Buddhist Centre, got more and more involved, and then like, you know, the classic kind of impetus to do any kind of like big life introspection stuff split up with my girlfriend at the time. And basically
classic.
And then so for you know, for a while, like, Buddhism kind of became my girlfriend. And so I was doing that. I was going to the Buddhist center like 3 or 4 times a week. I was going on retreats, you know, like 5 or 6 retreats a year. Some of them like long silent retreats, like Vipassana style. And then I became a Mitra. Actually, funny enough, my neighbour, literally my next door neighbour, who is next door right now, he became a Mitra last night.
Oh, wow.
It's this wonderful, it's an amazing, beautiful ceremony where you just come, you basically, it's like coming out as a Buddhist. And you know, there's this whole ritual. You kind of go up to the shrine, you bow, and you offer a candle, and you offer a flower, and you offer some incense. And they all symbolise different things. But so yeah,
but it's a non-dogmatic.
No, it's not.
Is it dogmatic?
Well,
it kind of.
I think anything. The thing is that you're dicing with in any kind of religious institution. You're dicing with forces of, you know, you're like, you're going around, you're opening up, you're sort of taking the top case off the human condition, and you're dicking around with like horrible things like ego that can give you harsh electric shocks.
Yeah.
And then you're putting a bunch of other people who are doing the same in some kind of institution that is like necessarily trying to get these people to form some community and some kind of collective shared goal and shared sort of understanding of the world that helps these people move in a direction that will you know, improve their life, or not necessarily improve their lives, but improve their understanding and acceptance of the human condition. So there is just that's just inherently dogma. I mean, you know, Buddhism I often hear people say that, like, you know, out of all the religions, you know, Buddhism would be the one I go for.
I suppose with Buddhism, it just doesn't have as many, like, it's less provable and less arguable.
Yeah, and it's also very kind of tool based. It's a tool based religion, and you know, the Buddha did say, well, I don't know if the Buddha said, but there are things, there are like bits of paper that people have written stuff on that said that the Buddha says that you know, don't just take these practices as, you know, as read. Try them out. Try them out in the fire yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is, you know, I mean, you know, basically the entirety of the, you know, the sort of like secular mindfulness movement, which is massive nowadays with like Headspace and Calm, and like, every, you know, everyone under the age of 40 has some kind of relationship with meditation these days, it seems. 95% of those teachings, you know, come from stuff that was written down by the Buddha. Written down by the Buddha, again, you know, with all those caveats about, you know, we don't really know who wrote it down, but, you know, it's all kind of down there, but it's very tool based. And once you get into the weeds with Buddhism, there is a whole sort of theology, and there's a, you know, there's a big mythology behind it. But then, I mean, the other, so this is where you really get into the dogma kind of stuff. Is that like anything that any path that's trying to get you to kind of think outside your own life and think outside this kind of very sort of like first person point of view.
Yeah.
The only way you can really do that is with kind of like, you know, myth and metaphor and stuff like that. And I think this is where all like the God stuff gets really confused, because, you know, when I was a teenager, I got into like hardcore Christianity when I was a teenager. Didn't go well at all. I mean, and I kind of popped out of it angrier and more confused. But still, you know, there are readings, and you know, there's friends of mine who are like very, very devout Christians. You know, a family friend of ours who's an ordained priest, and you know, I've met with her, and she's clearly like the way that she kind of embraces the practices that she's learned. I'm just super impressed. I'm super impressed about how she's used it to change her life, how she's used it to do good in lives around her. But then there's always this weird, like, kooky end where you get into the whole mythology. And you get into metaphor and archetypes and stories and myth. And, like, you kind of need, like, after a certain point, you kind of need that stuff to lead you on to something bigger.
It almost feels like, rarely does it seem to have, like, don't do that. It's more, should you do that?
Yeah, exactly. It's the consequences. Like, but I mean, that's the law of karma. But, you know, accidents. Actions have consequences, basically.
But then it also seems to carry with it that, well, it doesn't actually matter if this is true. Whether or not it happened, whether or not you truly believe it happened, doesn't actually affect the lesson it's trying to teach you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, the most important thing is, like, what does it do to your mind?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, so you could read. I mean, there's this weird thing actually. When so at my kind of like peak Buddhism, which I'd say probably happened like 2013, 2014 was definitely peak Buddhism for me. And that's also not to say that I have less time to do it nowadays, because I'm basically the founder / CEO of a startup. So you don't get that much time to go on retreat, but you know, it's something I do want to get back to someday. Anyway, at a, certain point when I was really, you know, I was really into kind of reading all the literature and doing all the rituals and going on the retreats, and I started to read, like, my entire life, like, everything that happened. You know, your entire life starts to become a teaching. And, like, things that, just weird stuff that happens in the street, or just normal stuff that happens in the street, become kind of, like, reflections about, you know, impermanence, about death, or they become opportunities to kind of move towards a sort of compassionate way of thinking about things, rather than just, like, fuck you, I'm out for myself way of thinking about things, you know. So, again, I can't remember what point I was trying to prove, but it's like that, it becomes, that's it.
Well, it's helped you have a understanding of the value of your own experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also that it just goes so that, you know, if you can train your mind to, you can train your mind to be angry. You know, if you indulge your anger, you'll train your mind to be angry.
This is what we're doing online. Yes,
exactly.
Culture we're in there. And I'm super guilty of it. Actually, like,
you're not going to be right when you're dead.
All those phrases, like, life's too short.
Right, yeah. I was thinking, like, well, yeah, that sounded a bit like kind of soundbitey, didn't it? You're not going to be right when you're dead.
But, like, life is too short to waste time on stuff. But at the same time, there's nothing wrong with using some of your life to try and make the world better.
Yeah.
You know?
And also, like, I still waste time. I still catch myself wasting time, and, you know, like, scrolling through Twitter or just doing pointless stuff.
Yeah.
And there's so much that I've got to learn from how I waste time for, like, how I could not waste time in the future. And that's not, when I talk about that, I'm not talking about, like, some sort of productivity, like 10 productivity tips, tips on, like, how to power up your day, how to get 35% more productivity out of your day. It's like, absolutely not that kind of stuff. Yeah. It's more like, you know, how can I, like, appreciate this, like, you know, the gift of experience without wanting to sound too sort of...
But it is that thing sometimes that you don't realise that when you perceive yourself wasting time, you might not be wasting time. It might actually be, you know, when I'm standing in my kitchen for 10 minutes just looking out the window, it's because my brain needs to be doing something and looking out the window is entertaining me enough while my brain gets on with whatever it's got to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's like sometimes those downbeats, sometimes those moments where you're just noodling, that's fine because you need to do that. You know, I think we're in this culture now where we're chasing the money, chasing the acclaim or whatever so hard that we forget to actually enjoy, you know. I've got a friend, he might listen to this, he might not, who's working 8 hours a week for a tech company, and he's earning really good money. Yet, he's not been able to spend any of that money because he had absolutely no time. Now, thankfully for him, he's got a plan. He's set himself an exit point, which is the day he comes out of debt, basically.
Right.
So he knows that I'm going to go through this for the next 2 years, but there's an end. But yeah. There's a lot of people who don't write that end in stone.
Yeah.
And just spend 10 years stressed.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely guilty of that. I mean, I wouldn't say I have an entirely healthy relationship with work, which definitely ties into this whole kind of wasting time thing. And, you know, sometimes it's almost quite comedy. Like I've had a stressful day or something, you know, my girlfriend come back from work and I'll just like, as soon as I've got that frame of reference of someone else in the room, and I'm running around and says, no, I'm too stressed. No, I can't do this. I've got to do these emails. I've got to do this whatever thing. And you know, that may or may not be true, but what isn't true is like, you know, that tone of the tone of voice that kind of tone of being and tone of expressing is just totally unnecessary. And I can kind of see myself doing it at the time, just like, there's no need to be a dick like this. but then it's just hard, especially when, you know, when you kind of, I guess when you risk a lot, you know, which I have for Endless, I've risked everything. I've risked everything for Endless. And I've also persuaded a lot of other people to risk a lot of stuff as well. Mm. You know, it's quite hard. It's just, well, the natural way for me to respond to that is just get super stressed about it and take everything really seriously and you know, work way too hard and, you know, have, you know, unhealthy working periods and some, you know.
There is a point in your day, though, where the work you're doing is a diminishing return. You know, you can only think creatively, you can only think clearly for a certain amount of time each day.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, again, back to the games industry with these sort of crunch periods. They have the 6 months or a year before a game comes out where people are working these extreme weeks.
Yeah.
And then games are still launching in a broken state. And it's because a third of their workforce, work hours, are people who are too tired. Or, you know, you hear stories that developers of Fortnite, people were sleeping under their desks in sleeping bags and then getting straight back and go, you know, you're not going to do your best work, you know, when you haven't seen your family or eaten.
Yeah.
Basic human sustenance is handy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I'm a lot better at it. Lot better at it now. And, you know, a couple of years ago, I was running Team Exile Limited, you know, actively making plug-in products.
Yeah.
Selling them, doing all the videos, doing the shop, doing the marketing, pretty much everything. You know, I had a bit of help on some stuff, but not really that much.
Yeah.
And I was pretty much doing everything. And I was running Endless. And I was doing, like, kind of creative tech projects and, like, branded content things. And I was doing, like, some Team Exile gigs. And I was poor. Basically, all the cash that came from that, like, went straight back into Endless, like, paying everyone's salaries and stuff like that. Which, looking back on it, was insane. Oh, yeah, I was managing a government grant as well, which is, like... and it was brutal. And I totally had a massive burnout. I've never experienced... It's properly... Like, it's a physical sensation. And, like, weird anxiety. Like, I don't know. It's hard to describe it. I went on holiday with my girlfriend and my family. And I went on there. You know, I went that holiday feeling, like, stressed and, like... But still, you know, kind of on it. And in a period of a week, I just crumbled. It was weird. And, like, my whole adrenal system went, like, okay, we've given you... One strike, two strike, three strikes. You know, you've had the back pain, you've had the cold that didn't go away, and now you've got the insomnia, which is decreasing from like 6 hours a night to 3 hours a night sleep.
We're meant to get more than three. Christ.
Yeah. And then it was just like, right, okay, body was just like, you're not listening. We're shutting you down.
Yeah.
And I had to take I took 2 months off.
I'm truly amazed at our own ability to put ourselves through hell to get to some perceived end goal. We build these ideas of responsibility in our mind that might not almost be there. Yes, I've got to make this work to pay my rent and feed myself, etc., etc. But I think we forget sometimes how many safety nets we have in the people around us, how many, you know, like how much we could actually be could you just take this one thing off my plate for me? Or could you just reassure me that I'm doing this okay? You know? And all the cheesy, like, taking that time to smell the roses, etc., etc. Taking time to smell your own farts, whatever. But they're important things. And that time is going to make what you do to earn your living better. You know, taking a break. Because, you ended up crumbling and, you know, you could have crumbled far worse than you did and never got back up again.
Yeah, well, everything's fucked. I thought, you know, you were talking about this whole support network thing, but actually, you know, like a couple of weeks after it happened, I was literally spark out on the sofa. I couldn't, I couldn't even like really string a sentence together to the people I was sort of handing, you know. So a friend of mine came in and sort of like just ran, you know, ran the team for a couple of months. Like, amazing. I'm so grateful to him. You know, I was trying to hand stuff out. I couldn't even string a sentence together about the stuff I was just handing over. It was nuts. And I spoke to a friend of mine, who had been through a similar thing a couple of years before. Actually, it turns out, like, so many people have been through this.
Yeah.
It's nuts how many
people. It's funny because everyone listening to this will, like, the episode that comes out tomorrow for us, but 2 weeks ago for them, we have the same conversation. Darren had, just before he started working with Run the Jewels, he was done. You know, he had that collapse moment, and he was completely numb, and he's, as he calls it, his recovery came about taking the job on the second Run the Jewels album and then having Run the Jewels, like, aggressive, upbeat beat soundtracking that. Like, he's basically Rocky training montage and back to fighting shape. But it's spoken to how he runs his business. He's got he's about to have 9 staff, but, like, he sends people home at 6 o'clock. That's when you finish work. You don't get to stay here and, like, if it's not done, it can be done tomorrow. And I think we as a culture put so much pressure on ourselves to reach some unattainable goals. And the only real goal you should be aiming for is to go to bed happy. I don't even mean that you have to be happy all the time. But if you can just, like, get to bedtime and think, no, that was good. I did it.
Yeah.
I achieved this one thing today.
You know? But I think there's something kind of cyclical about it. Like, you know, kind of accepting a cyclical nature of things. You know, like small cycle, you know, it's like breathing. Is a cycle that lasts, I don't know, 3 or 4 seconds. And then, you know, like a day's work is a cycle. But then also, you know, there's, you know, in running a bit, you know, running, well, like my artist career, there was cycles of, like, you know, gigs and tours and promo and, like, being a bit more in the spotlight. And then there's fallow periods, and that goes again. It's the same with working in Endless. You know, we've just kind of come off the back of a bit of a sprint, you know, launching the beta. I tripped myself up by trying to make it trip.
You went through that sprint and now you...
that said, it's kind of like... Though that's a tricky thing with startup life is that, you know, for me, you know, as the founder, I have to be careful, like, how to do these cycles, because these cycles kind of come pretty, like, thick and fast. It's just like, right, okay, we did the launch. Well, now we need to raise some funding. Once we've closed this funding round, we'll probably have to move on to the next one. I don't know. It seems to be working out at the moment. It's just I know that, like, if I feel like I need a day, you know, the last 4 weeks, I think I've worked pretty much every day the last 4 weeks in some capacity. Apart from this weekend, went out to my girlfriend's family. And, you know, so that was just a really good thing. I felt a lot of the weekend like, oh, I really should be. You know, I knew there was, like, a bunch of emails and, like, a bunch of sort of potential investment conversations that I should be following up on, and things, you know, leads that I shouldn't be generating, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I was just like, no. I know if I don't go like let myself kind of go to ground and just.
But it's a weird thing because like you not answering that email for a day or two isn't going to change that person's whether they want to put money in or not. You know, like people make up their mind. Like I can't remember who he was. I was reading about someone just yesterday, and the guy is a big, well-known investor, but he was talking about all the things he said no to. And he was like, he said no to Snapchat.
Yeah.
And in the interview, he's saying, like, if they had said, sold it to me as self-deleting porn, I would have put money in, but they didn't. You know? I think that happens with everything. Like, if you worry about what somebody else thinks or how to change their mind, then you're already smashing your head against the wall enough as it is.
I mean, it is a bit like that in an investment round, though. You know, I hold out hope for all conversations until someone is explicitly like, I'm out.
it's no different to the like trying to get a record label experience.
Yeah.
Me and Pip walking around going to like fucking Warner and Universal and all the big labels, and then also having the smaller meetings, and then you're like, who's gonna come in? And
yeah.
Like one label were like, yeah, we'll sign you, but only if you change your name. And like you start, oh, could we have said something? Could we have done something? It's like, it doesn't matter.
It's the ultimate kind of like insecurity generator. I mean, it's definitely a whole other level of anxiety to deal with. And actually, like now third time out, I'm a bit like, oh, okay, yeah, I know. Like, I know the stories that I'll be telling myself about various people. You know, someone doesn't get back, or you know, you've got a good lead, and then they go silent. Yeah. And I think the weirdest thing about it is like you are so in the mercy of fate.
Mm.
You know, all you can do is like put the action in, do the best you can, learn from any feedback that people
give
you.
Which comes back to what we were saying earlier, that success is often an outside influence.
Yes.
And you have no control over that.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I 100% buy into that. But I think there's definitely something like, you know, the phrase I like is that you make your own luck.
Yeah, you're prepared to react when the luck shows itself, in a sense.
Like, yeah,
getting yourself in that position that when the opportunity presents itself, that you can actually act on it.
Exactly. No, I really believe in the potential of, you know, music as a sort of like gamified creative collaborative experience that we can have that people can get really good at and can also be really fun, and there's a whole ecosystem like that. Like I'm 110% sold on that.
You said something in another podcast, you're not meant to be good at the game. Like when you first play something, you're not there because you're instantly going to be the best in the world. You're there because you see someone doing something fun, then you want to do it too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is why. I keep on coming back to football analogies, but like this is why football is so massive.
But that's also because you went to your first football
match. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And then it was, oh my god, this is brilliant.
But it was. But then, like, you know, I kind of, you know, obviously, like, there is no one in this world who doesn't have a relationship with football.
Mm.
Whether that relationship is like, I'm not into football, but you know, that is a relationship to football.
For me, like, just I was into football, and then like music pushed it out.
Right.
But I think it was what actually pushed football away was my penis. It was like, because music came in, and then that obviously then intrinsically linked with social life and women,
your penis, right? Yeah,
and women and playing football with my penis. No, but like, do you know what I mean? And it was just like thing of like, well, I can talk to that girl about Portishead, or I can talk to that lad about Bruce Grobbelaar.
Right.
Have you heard the new Portishead?
Yeah.
I like your hair.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, no, it is. Yeah.
Hey, there you are. How was that then? I really enjoyed that. We definitely are both ramblers. It was one of the more rambly ones, but we got to the nub of some creative ideas, and it was actually really interesting to realize just how much work goes into developing an app like that when you're not a global corporation who can throw infinite money at it. I don't envy the endless cruise stress levels, but I do think they're at the start of something quite big. So yeah, show them some love at Endless on Twitter, 3 S's. Show Tim some love. I think he runs at Endless as well, but at Tim Exile as well, I'm guessing. I haven't looked. Just Google Tim Exile. And don't forget to check out the app. Like I say, either the Twitter, on my Twitter, just the thread, the pinned post for this podcast, we'll have a link to it in there, or patreon.com/DanLasak. The public post on there will be, have the link in there. I keep saying the public post, it's just because I'm trying to give you a place to go without it being me going, oh, if you give me money, you can have thing. Because I don't run my life in that way. Anyway, next time we've got, let's just say, Scratchy Man. One of those people who's just offensively talented, basically. So tune in for that. Well, I don't think I can tell you anymore without just spilling the beans on who it is. But hit the subscribe button, or the like, I don't know what the buttons are. But hit all the buttons so that you can get it as soon as it happens, and come to Patreon, do all those things. I don't know, I'm really bad at the self-promotion part of this. It feels unnatural to me. It feels really unnatural. So I tell you what, why don't you go do it for me on my behalf? Like, go tweet about the podcast, retweet it, post it on Facebook, tell your granny about the podcast. She needs a bit of Dan Lasak in her life. Go on. You can do it. Well, on that note to get your granny involved, I'll run away. Thank you in advance for spreading the good word. And I'll see you next time.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.